You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, supported by MyWoosh. MyWoosh is the virtual cycling platform that can energise and invigorate your indoor riding, whether you just want to get on and pedal, because like riding outdoors, it's free to get started, or you want to follow a structured training programme and improve your fitness and work towards a specific goal, or maybe you want to test yourself to the maximum by taking part in one of the races. MyWoosh has got something for every level of cyclist, or you can just get on and explore the various different worlds that MyWoosh has to offer. Now, we're very grateful to MyWoosh for that support since the start of the Tour de France, with our preview episodes way back at the end of June, all the way through the men's tour and the Tour de France Femme, which finished at the weekend, of course. And that support helped us to be there on the ground covering the races up close inside the bubble. And more than that, the funding has enabled us to already start planning for 2027, when we'll be at the Grand Départ in Edinburgh and the Grand Départ in Leeds. I'd like to say a huge thank you to everyone at MyWoosh, but especially Rob Jarman, who we've worked with very closely over the past few weeks. I've really enjoyed getting to grips with the MyWoosh platform. I've ridden quite a few of the courses now, and I can say some of them are pretty challenging, but there's also ways to just spin the legs in quite a relaxed, leisurely way. So I'm looking forward to the clocks going back in October, when I'm going to dive into MyWoosh and ride on the indoor bike through the winter. If you want to give it a whirl, go to mywoosh.com, have a look at what it all looks like, see what you're letting yourself in for. The easiest way to get started is to go to your app store and download the MyWoosh app for your device. It will pair up with your smart trainer, turn the pedals, and away you go. So happy riding, and a big thank you to MyWoosh.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Welcome to the Cycling Podcast, coming out of hibernation with me, Graham Wilgos, for this in-betweeners episode is Lionel Burney. Lionel, we're re-emerging, blinking into the light after the Tour de France, which feels like a long time ago now, partly because it is. I say blinking into the light, we're blinking into the microphone, really, aren't we?
Yeah, 3 weeks, a long time in cycling. Does 3 weeks at home post-tour feel the same length of time as 3 weeks on the road at the tour? I'm not sure it does.
No, not for me, Clive.
No.
That sense of time passes by. I think it feels longer. Just because the time passes so quickly when you're constantly on the move, or more or less constantly on the move. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, it's not like the world of cycling has come to a halt either. There's been lots of racing on the men's side, which we'll recap in a moment, but also the Tour de France Femme, brilliantly covered by Rose Manley, Denny Gray and Lizzie Banks. Hopefully everyone has kept up to date with what went on. There was beef and drama, wasn't there? And, catch up with the episode
and cheese,
if you're a bit behind. Yeah. And cheese, yes, of course. And a lovely finish on the French Riviera down in Nice. I mean, they really had a spectacular route, didn't they? They had Switzerland, Mont Ventoux.
Yeah, incredible race, incredible route, and brilliantly covered. So I say in between his episode because we're coming in between Denny, Rose and Lizzie, and Daniel Freeb and his normal Vuelta programming, which will return next week.
Yes, there'll be a preview episode next week. I'll be off on holiday, and Daniel will be taking care of the Vuelta a España again, which starts in a couple of weeks' time, doesn't it? The 22nd of August that starts. And, well, should we just recap what has happened between the Tour de France and now? Because there's almost indecent haste that the San Sebastian Classic comes around, isn't it? It almost feels like, I don't feel like I've got my land legs back by that Saturday afternoon when San Sebastian is on. And it always amazes me that there are so many of the riders and the team staff and everyone, they're back in action so soon after the Tour de France has finished.
Yeah, and it didn't disappoint either, did it? And it almost, in a way, and certainly in the way it finished, it felt like a stage of the Tour, a mountain stage of the Tour was relived at the end of San Sebastian with it came down to Remco Evenepoel versus Richard Carapaz.
Yeah, and Remco Evenepoel won his fourth edition of San Sebastian, breaking the record held by Marino Lajarreta, who won the very first edition back in 1981 and then won two more after that. So Remco, the first four-time winner of San Sebastian. Richard Carapaz, though, was the star of that final weekend of the tour, wasn't he? Of the, you know, the final three mountain stages, and clinched that King of the Mountain jersey, clearly in roaring form and just coming up short against kind of the faster finisher, really.
The faster finisher, and he was the only one, though, who could stay with Evenepoel after he made that attack in the final few kilometres to go clear and stay clear, despite the efforts of the chasing group, led home by Ben Tulit for Team Visma Lisa Bike. Third place, 30 seconds behind, but Visma Lisa Bike have had a pretty impressive sort of intervening period elsewhere as well, and Tulit has featured elsewhere too.
Yeah, well, the Tour of Denmark was, the first 3 days were dominated by Wout van Aert. He won three in a row. One of the riders Visma Lisa Bike probably missed at the Tour de France, especially once Jonas Vingegaard crashed out and they had to resort to a plan B. Van Aert would have been a very handy plan B, wouldn't he? But he won three stages in Denmark, and that was enough to give him the overall title there as well. Stage wins for Storm Ingebrigtsen. Always makes me think of Jakob Ingebrigtsen, the 5,000 and 10,000 metre runner who won a very impressive 5,000 metres on the track at the Europeans last night.
Was that last night, wasn't it? I saw him being interviewed afterwards.
And Rasmus Pedersen won the other stage in Denmark. But Van Aert building up, I think, now to the Vuelta a España, which he's going to ride for Visma Lisa Bike. And, well, he's clearly recovered from the injuries which kept him out of the Tour de France.
Visma also had a good time at the Tour of Poland, didn't they? Won overall by Tudor Pro Cycling's Marco Brenner, who just about held off Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe's Finn Fischer Black in the final stage time trial. I wanted to say team time trial there, institutionalised by the Tour, but it was an individual time trial won by Stefan Kung. So a very good day for Tudor Pro Cycling. Finn Fischer Black finished second behind Stefan Kung on the day, just the 4 seconds back, but it was Brenner who finished 11 seconds back, giving him a 10 second cushion on GC. I think my maths is correct there for anyone following along. But Visma also had a quietly impressive time just by winning a stage, just the one stage, wasn't it?
No, it's two actually, Graham.
Two stages, sorry.
Bart Lemon won stage four. That was the one that was interrupted by a really big crash with about 40k to go, and they chopped 15k out of the route and reorganized it and then neutralized it for a while because so many riders came down, and it was a real big crash. But Bart Lemon won that one ahead of Christian Scaroni, and then a couple of days later Louis Barré, French rider with Visma Lisa Bike, got his first professional win. You mentioned Stefan Kung getting the time trial win. I mean, it's been a pretty horrendous season for him because he crashed out of Omloop Het Nieuwsblad at the end of February, broke his femur, and came back in time for the Swiss National Championships in June. But this is the first time he's raced since then. So he's had a very, very long comeback from that injury. And that was, in fact, his first pro win since the Chrono des Nations in October 2024. So must have been good for him to be back on the podium as a stage winner in a time trial again. The other stages there, well, Jan Christen of UAE won stage five, and there was another hat trick, Graham, because Jonathan Milan of Lidl Trek won the first three bunch sprints. That's the cycling equivalent of a hat trick. Does a hat trick have to be three stages one in a row? I think it does, really, rather.
I reckon that counts as a perfect hat trick. So it's the equivalent of your left foot, right foot header. But it was the battle of the sprinters, not at the Tour de France, wasn't it? It was Jonathan Milan for Little Trek versus Paul Magnier for Soudal Quickstep. Milan coming in ahead of Magnier for the first two stages, and then adding the third stage ahead of EF Education Easy Post's Noah Hobbs, the 22-year-old Brit, with Magnier relegated from 14th place to 121st on stage, I think it was stage four, yes, stage four, for deviating from his line in the sprint. So Milan very much on top in the battle of the sprinters there.
Yeah, Noah Hobbs, actually, as you mentioned him, he won the opening stage of the Tour de l'Ain, which was on right after the Tour de France finished. I found myself slouching on the sofa, watching cycling, the sun blazing away outside. I did question what I was doing, but I was so tired after the Tour that just sitting in front of the TV for an afternoon was quite a nice diversion from being constantly on the move. EF Education, Easy Post had a very good few days at the Tour de l'Ain, didn't they? Because yeah. Markel Bolocki also won a stage and took the overall for them. But Tour of Poland, yeah, a victory for Tudor, three stage winners for Jonathan Milan, and Visma Lisabike, as you say, getting a couple of wins. And they also had a couple of wins at the Vuelta a Burgos, which is the traditional build-up race for the Vuelta a España. Matt Brennan, who we saw sort of this time last year sprinting very well at the Tour of Britain, he won the opening stage and stage four for Visma Lisabike. Oscar Onley, of course, missed the Tour de France for Net Company Ineos after crashing out of the Not Dauphiné. He won the stage that finished uphill at Pineda de la Sierra. And Felix Gall, very impressive at the Giro d'Italia in May, finishing runner-up to Jonas Vingegaard. He won the third stage, and that was more or less enough to give him the overall victory ahead of Onley. The final stage was won by Giulio Pellizzari, who just missed out on being the best Giulio at the Vuelta a Burgos because Giulio Ciccone finished third overall. So we can see some riders, you know, getting their seasons going again after not riding the Tour de France and the preparations for the Vuelta a España in full swing.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is also sponsored by NordVPN, the best and fastest virtual private network that there is. Now, if you're travelling somewhere, you'll be connecting to the internet either on 5G or maybe in your hotel or maybe out in a public hotspot. And you probably don't think too much about the security of those connections. At least I didn't until a few years ago, quite a few years ago now, actually, when I realized that the benefits of having a NordVPN subscription would far, far outweigh the risks of surfing the internet without the protection that NordVPN can offer, because it keeps all of your connections safe and secure, meaning that when you're online, any information that you're transmitting over the internet will be safe. So if you're logging into your online bank account, making a payment, transferring money, you know that that connection is going to be safe and secure. It will also protect you from viruses and phishing attempts. And if you do click on an email and find that it wasn't what you were expecting, NordVPN has got your back. If you'd like to give it a go, you can get a great deal at nordvpn.com/TCP. If you sign up for a 2-year NordVPN subscription, you'll get 4 months extra for free added on. And once you've subscribed, I suspect that you'll be like me and you'll have all of your devices protected at all times. You can protect up to 10 connections, 10 devices at the same time with one account. So I've got it on my laptop, my phone, tablet, even our internet router and smart TV. So go to nordvpn.com/TCP to find out more. Shall we complete stage 22 of the 2026 Tour de France? We said we would do a press conference episode wrapping up some of the questions. Lots of questions to answer that have been sent in via SpeakPipe. We'll probably keep that going on and off. Maybe in the off-season we'll do another press conference style episode. But the first one, Graham, I thought we could tackle. Several people during the closing few days of the Tour de France asked us the same question, including Steve in Eastbourne, Anna in Quebec, and Darren in Glasgow, basically asking whether we thought Tadej Pogacar would go to the Vuelta a España this year and try to complete the Grand Tour Grand Slam. Well, we now know the answer, of course. He is going to be on the start line in Monaco on August the 22nd, leading the UAE Team Emirates lineup. And, I mean, I don't want to be presumptuous, but can we see anything other than a Pogacar victory? I mean, everyone else who's been preparing for the Vuelta to round off the Grand Tour season must have sort of sighed a bit of a groan as they heard the news that Pogacar was going to be there, because it does really probably put victory out of reach of pretty much everybody else, unless, of course, Pogacar is unwell or injured in some way. If he's in even sort of 85, 90% of his best, he's probably going to win, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine, can't you? You know, your Primoz Roglic at Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, and he sort of picks up the newspaper and he's doing what? Oh, for God. But it is a little bit of a full circle moment in a way, because you've got, you know, this is maybe Primoz Roglic's last real dig at a grand tour when he's going to be a real serious contender. And we know how successful he's been at the Vuelta with his four titles. He's going for number five in the same way that Pogacar, in the same year that Pogacar's done his five at the Tour de France. So there's a lot of sort of pleasing kind of mirror images here already. And Pogacar was asked about, he talked to a Slovenian outlet called MMC in the week, and sort of said that when he won the time trial at La Planche de Belfie to take his first Tour de France, his heart broke a little bit when he crossed the line, because he knew that he had taken the time away from Roglic that Roglic needed to win his first and what would have been his only tour. So there's a pleasing sort of symmetry to this Vuelta. And Pogacar going in, I want to say he's looking to become the ninth man to do the hat trick of grand tours. Yes, he is the ninth man. Can you name them all?
Oh, goodness.
The eight that have gone before him. Can you name them in order? You can definitely name them all, but can you name them in order? Starting with Jacques Anquetil.
Well, it'd be Jacques Anquetil. Then did Gimondi do it next? Felice Gimondi?
He certainly did, yes.
Eddie Merckx did it, obviously. That's three.
Yep.
Bernardino.
Correct.
Is that four?
That's four out of four.
And then
you're on a roll.
Still going in chronological order. So we're into the 80s. Who won all three? Well, can I go backwards now?
Yeah, of course you can.
So Vingegaard, obviously. Do you know, this is a real phenomenon. My cycling knowledge is pretty good. And then there's a real black spot in there's a real kind of empty space of kind of recent years, but I've got Vincenzo Nibali.
Yeah, two to go.
Chris Froome.
Very good. One to go.
This is killing me. So it's got to be between.
Would you like me to give you the race that he began with, the Grand Tour that he started with?
No. Contador.
Very good. Oh. Got there in the end. What a relief. Well, Tadej Pogacar be number nine.
I think he will, won't he? It's, yeah, like I say, rough on the other riders who might have had an eye on winning the Vuelta. But from Pogacar's point of view, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? I mean, he's had a very light race program leading into the Tour de France. I think he only did 16 days of racing before the Tour started, if memory serves. He's, you know, what's he got left to kind of tick off on the list of races? He wants to complete the set of Grand Tours, obviously, having won the Tour and the Giro. The Vuelta's the only one left. And this is the ideal opportunity to do it. The only sort of thing that gets in the way a bit, I suppose, is the fact that the World Championships are in Canada, which means, you know, it's not a long flight, but it does mean a bit of adjustment to the time difference and so on. And, you know, you can't legislate for how the body might respond to that. And the fact that the European Championships are in his home country, Slovenia, which, okay, he's won that before, but he'll clearly want to race on home soil. You can't imagine him missing that. So, but it's the ideal opportunity for Pogacar to target the Vuelta. Well, we'll see. Maybe we'll be all surprised and we'll be talking about somebody else at the middle of September, but I can't see it, to be honest.
Yeah, Oscar Onley for net company Ineos, maybe, yet to be named on their start list proper, but every indication is that after his successful Burgos, only being 5 seconds off GC, off of taking the title, you think it'll be him and Carlos Rodriguez, the sort of forgotten man?
Yeah, I mean, Oscar Onley, I would expect to ride. When I had a chat with Dave Brailsford at the Tour de France, he said that was the plan. I mean, they were really pretty gutted that Onley was not able to start the tour. I mean, he was too badly bashed up, and it wouldn't have been ideal for him to go into the tour as a kind of joint leader, even of Netcompany Ineos, carrying any sort of injury. There would have been pressure on him anyway, I think, just being the British leader of the team. But the plan was to reset and get fit and ready and be right for the start of the Vuelta and see how well he can go in that. I mean, Brailsford did say that he felt that Onley would have been in that next knot of riders, you know, maybe not on the same level as Pogacar, but then who is? But then in that group of riders that was consistently sort of all racing against each other, really. And the question would have been, would he have been able to kind of put together a race to challenge Evenepoel for second place? Would he have been able to challenge for a place on the podium? Or would he have been in that next little knockdown with the sort of Paul Sexas, that kind of group? But they felt that he was in good enough racing shape at the Tour Auvergne-Rhône-Alpes to be in that sort of company. So we'll get to see probably at the Vuelta whether that's the case. Well, let's not preempt the Vuelta preview, which will be coming next week with Daniel Freiber. And should we get into some questions after the break?
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car, the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet again to remind me to tell you that this episode is also supported by me, Lionel Burney, and my very good friend Simon Gill. Now, you may remember a few years ago we went off on an adventure together for the Cycling Podcast. We cycled around Scotland, visiting all of the Scottish Football League grounds for a series that we called the Tour de Corse. And, well, it was a very well-received series, actually. Lots of listeners liked it, even though lots of cycling fans are slightly football-phobic. We get lots of complaints when we mention football. People seem to enjoy the series because it wasn't really about football. It wasn't really about cycling either. It was about two friends going on an adventure. Well, Simon and I are off again on our travels. We're going to be supporting and following our hometown football club, Hemel Hempstead Town, over the course of the 2026-27 season for a new podcast called The Magic Roundabout. Now, why is it called The Magic Roundabout? Well, it's named after the closest thing that Hemel Hempstead has to a tourist attraction, which is a multi-directional roundabout that really is the hub of everything that goes on in Hemel. Now, the football club operates in the sixth tier of English football, just five promotions away from making it to the Premier League. But it's grassroots sport at its finest, and we're going to be meeting the people and personalities that make the club tick. We're going to be travelling home and away. We're going to be answering all sorts of questions like, why is there a racing pigeon club inside the football ground? And why is King Henry VIII on the club badge? Now, the first episode is out now. You can find it in your podcast player. It's called The Magic Roundabout. And, well, it will be Simon and I off on our travels. So even if you don't like football, give it a chance. You might enjoy it. And there might even be some cycling too.
So, Lionel, our third and final press conference, and let's use this loosely, of the tour, given how far away we are from that. Now, no Simon Gill to keep us in check this time round, so perhaps our answers will be that much more liberated. let's see. Question number one.
Hi, it's Richard from Hornsey in Hampshire, long-time friend of the podcast, and a huge fan of the work you do, so thank you very much. I'm intrigued as to where does one Tour de France victory compare to multiple Grand Tour victories? For example, if you compared the Palmares of Geraint Thomas to Primoz Roglic, which would you rank higher? Do you think one Tour de France win with a couple of week-long stage races compares more favourably to Primoz, who's obviously got the four Vueltas, the Giro, but then a lot more single week stage race victories? So who would you prefer, Geraint Thomas or Primoz Roglic?
My first thought with this, Lionel, is that you take one Tour de France over 10 Vueltas, no?
Well, I mean, I would if it was me, if I was in the position where I could choose. I mean, that's the first thing, isn't it? Who gets the choice to choose, really? I mean, Primoz Roglic, would he swap four Vuelta titles for one Tour de France if it was the deal that he was offered? You know, if he'd been told, look, you can go back in time and hold on and not get beaten by Tadej Pogacar on La Planche de Belfi and win the 2020 Tour de France, but you don't win any of the Vueltas, would you take that? I suspect you possibly might, if it was just that stark a choice, because the Tour de France transcends absolutely everything, doesn't it? It's one of the great global sporting events. And I think you know, in the kind of the realm of cycling and world sport, more people would recognise the winner of one Tour de France than the multiple winners of the Vuelta or even the Giro, I suspect.
I always remember interviewing Mark Cavendish for the first time in 2015 for Sport magazine, and Cav would have been on 20-something stages at that point, 20-something stage wins, and he was sort of protesting that he wasn't recognised in the way that he should be, because winning one stage of the Tour de France would make a rider's career, let alone winning 20-something, let alone winning 35, as he now has. So I think you're right, it does, it totally transcends sport. And is recognised on a completely different level. So in a way, the choice is quite straightforward, but it would be interesting, wouldn't it, to put it to Roglic and say, maybe if he wins his fifth, what would you rather have, Primoz? Five Vueltas or one Tour de France?
And then Pogacar can pop up and say, well, what would you rather have? Five Tours de France or five Vueltas? I mean, again, easy question to answer that one. I think certainly also on a sort of team sponsorship basis, one Tour de France stage win a season pretty much dwarfs everything else. Like in terms of like delivering value for the sponsor, delivering return on investment, delivering eyeballs and attention to the team and the sponsors, a Tour de France stage win can be enough. You know, it can be enough.
This goes
to say,
back to your conversation with Jonathan Waters, doesn't it? Before the Tour de France, or at the end of the Giro, sorry, last year, which is well worth listening to again, or listening to for the first time if you haven't already.
And I think we're so immersed in cycling, we still find that quite surprising sometimes. What would be more valuable? Would a Tour de France stage win be of greater importance to a team than even a Giro d'Italia overall victory? And I think it's really close. I think in terms of being able to market that and sell that and attract investment sponsorship off the back of that, the Tour de France just absolutely dwarfs everything else. So, yeah, I mean, Geraint Thomas, you know, he won the Tour de France, and that is what people will always say about him now, even though he's won all those Olympic medals and you know, other races. It's always the Tour de France that takes top billing, and I think I mean, in the sort of global sporting sense, an Olympic gold medal is incredibly prestigious, means something to absolutely everybody. You know exactly what that means. But still, the Tour de France or an Olympic gold medal, I mean, that's really their kind of comparable, I think. You'd weigh those two things up. What would you rather have? And I still think that a cyclist, that's even one excellent on the track, would say, do you know what? I think the Tour de France over an Olympic gold medal. It really is that big, isn't it?
Yeah, agreed.
But it's not a problem that we're going to have to tackle, Graham. I don't think we're going to have
to. No, only hypothetically. And we're still agonising over it. So, next question, please.
Hi, Lionel and Graham. Justin here, an expat living in New Zealand. My question's about the Alp. Watching stage 19 this year at Alpe d'Huez was uncomfortable viewing, I found. The crowds barely felt in control, and I believe the Alp has now become more about getting drunk and partying. It felt like 80% of the people there, the fact that a bike race was happening was incidental. Indeed, the crowd certainly had a negative impact on Einar Rubio's race. I was amazed there were not more incidents. There were other mountain stages in the Tour with equally large crowds who were far more engaged and respectful of the race. Do you think it's now time to call time on the Alp?
Lionel, you and I sort of disagree on this, don't you? Although you do have the experience of having been there and the comparison of having been on Alpe d'Huez. in other tours, and I will only have seen it on TV, but it did feel like it was almost kind of fetishized this year, this time round, the sort of the sheer number of people on the Alp. It did feel like, not that you have to be there for the racing, but it did feel like it was sort of party first and, oh, by the way, there's a race on later. And I think back even to you and I driving up there on the Friday night, and being sort of feeling quite grateful that the car in front of us rather than our car was the one being rocked, which of course is all part of it. But I think you, having had the experience of other years, you're in a position to disagree and say, well, actually this year wasn't as bad as you might think.
Yeah, I'm wondering whether I misread this or not really, because I saw Tom Southam on our very good friend Mitch Docker's podcast, Life in the Peloton, and he said that the crowd on the mountain kind of crossed a line. And my sense was that it looked more controlled and regulated than I remember it being. I mean, barriering Dutch Corner, which always was absolutely chaotic. I mean, our friend Simon Gill has got a photo of the crowd so encroached on the road. It really is single file through there for the riders. And he got a great picture, I think was it 2018, possibly? Adam Hansen taking a beer from the spectators and, you know, having a sip and, you know, joining in the sort of party atmosphere. But I remember that was really extreme, how many people were on the mountain and just how close they got to the riders. And, you know, the party atmosphere did spill over a bit. I know that the Team Sky cars had a pretty rough journey from bottom to top that year with people slapping on the bonnet and on the roof of the car. And my sense was that this year wasn't quite as bad. But then, of course, there was the incident with Ina Rubio, which was terrible. And so maybe, you know, having to reevaluate my thoughts on it, especially as kind of we rode it as well, didn't we? I mean, we rode up from not far north of Dutch Corner, didn't we?
And we did the last 5Ks.
It felt fairly calm, and they barrier more of it every time. So my other sense is that these sections never used to have barriers. So it used to be absolutely crazy. I mean, do you remember 1999? It was on Alpe d'Huez, wasn't it? When Giuseppe Guerini was brought down by a spectator accidentally. But, you know, there's always been incidents. I think the Ina Rubio one was as bad as anything I've seen, because obviously the spectator that fell into the path of the UAE team car, the team car had no choice, couldn't drive over somebody in the road, which probably was the only, you know, the only other course of action. So they slammed on the brakes, and then Rubio was right on the bumper, slammed straight into the rear window and suffered some pretty bad injuries. And, you know, that's when it's very easy in hindsight to then say, this is crazy, this is out of control. But my sense on the day was that this has been worse. So I don't know. What's the solution really is, I think the education process goes on to, you know, make sure that the spectators stay back. I do think that the new invention, I mean, it's very simple, isn't it? But it's the thin metal post with the rope to keep the spectators off the actual tarmac. That's been effective. But we're getting to the point where maybe the solution is to have that approach all the way up the mountain. Because what happens is, where you barrier the crowd then goes somewhere else. And that makes bottlenecks and pinch points at other points on the mountain. So you're just moving the problem around. But then do we want the situation where, you know, 13, 14 kilometres of a climb is all crowd control? Maybe that's the point that it's going to get to.
This is Adrienne Hills in Erie, Pennsylvania. Those of us doing the Tour de Fleece are totally confused how the cycling teams can tolerate all the last-minute rule changes, especially neutralizing the final 48 kilometers or so of Stage 21. If this was to protect the GC cyclists from the chaos of the sprint finish, because I guess it really was a sprint finish, then do so at the 3, 5, or 8 kilometer mark. It seemed every news outlet even had a different number for the neutralization while the stage was ongoing. Can you tell that I wished Paul Sexus had been able to take the white jersey on this final day? Surely he's wondering that too. Is it really ASO's way or the highway?
Well, Adrian, the first thing we should probably say is that it's not ASO's way or the highway. Lionel, they're not the, although they are the ones who organise the race, they are not the ones who impose the rules.
No, they're not the jury. They're not the commissaires. That's the UCI. And there are written regulations. You can read them on the UCI website. Concerning how and when races can be altered, whether they're shortened because there'd been a crash like we saw at the Tour of Poland, or whether the GC times are taken at a particular point. And then this is communicated from the car, and it will be then broadcast over Radio Tour by our very good friend Seb Piquet, who will then tell all of the sports directors in the team cars what the decision of the jury and the commissaires is. And so no one's kind of racing in the dark, so to speak. It's not like the rules are ever changing. They generally make a call and then communicate that to the teams in one clear go. And then the riders will pick that up over their own race radios from their sports directors. I think where the confusion was on the final day of the tour was that there was a bit of confusion over whether it was 40k to go or 48k to go, because I think the stage had been reduced down to 88 and they took the times after a particular lap on the Champs-Élysées. And, you know, in the sort of the heat of the moment and the fog of the coverage, you know, was it with 40 to go or was it with 48 to go? I can't quite remember myself now. But the riders would have been clear on what that was. There was that little weird moment, though, wasn't there? Because when did Isaac Del Toro lose contact with the bunch? And, you know, did they get that all absolutely correct? Mm. I still don't quite know. But they took the times and Del Toro didn't lose any time overall. And, I mean, I think if you were going to point the finger at ASO for making the rules up on the hop, you might well have had more of a case if the rule had been applied in such a way that would have lifted Paul Seixas onto the podium. But that isn't what happened.
Yes, there weren't any questions to answer. It's almost like when you're making a cake, isn't it? And you need four eggs and you've got three. And then you have to kind of measure out all the other ingredients to make sure that it all tallies with the fact that you've only got three eggs. That's what that last day felt a little bit like. But in the end, the cake was good.
Yeah. Well, it was more of a souffle, I think, in the end, wasn't it? Because there was more egg than flour. So,
And no one with egg on their face. No.
Next question, please.
Hello, my name's Damien. I'm from Berkhamsted in the United Kingdom, which I'm guessing is within Not Watford. My question is about team radio. You obviously hear team radio quite often in the TV coverage, which always makes it quite interesting. But I'm always intrigued as to what the process is for that recording to appear on TV. Are technically all conversations over team radio available to television? And if so, does that have implications for what and how information is shared? Because technically any competitive team can hear it, or somehow are only some things selected and used. I just wondered how it worked. Thank you very much.
So, Lionel, I can start us off here by saying that, I mean, there's more of a gap than you'd think. It almost, when it's on the when it appears on the TV, it almost appears as you're seeing it as live. But I mean, obviously they have to, because of the time of day it's shown, they have to make sure there's no swearing in there. And not every communique makes it through to the live TV coverage. And it all, I don't know, a lot of the time it almost feels quite kind of bland. I'm not sure that it adds that much value.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, not every team is hooked up to the broadcaster every day. They kind of do that in a rotation, I think. So they're not being recorded every day. The teams don't want their tactical or even motivational messages to be broadcast kind of in real time. So you're absolutely right, Graham. There is a bit of a lag. And usually they play something after something has played out.
a bit, don't they? So it's kind of just adding a little bit of context, a little bit of layer to the coverage. I quite like it. I quite like hearing just how calm all of the sports directors sound when they're talking to the riders. When you consider what they're doing, all right, not all of them are driving. In fact, most of the sports directors on the radio are not driving. They're in the passenger seat. But they're watching the race on TV. They're trying to make sense of the picture in the race. They're trying to give clear, precise, calm instruction to their riders. And I think it's a really good insight into how the sports directors communicate with the riders. And I think it also shatters the assumption that we certainly had a few years ago that the riders were being almost sort of remote controlled by the sports directors and that they were carrying out tactical decisions, you know, almost like playing a video game. And I think when you hear those snippets of really kind of concise information or encouragement or whatever, there's often very little emotion in the voice. You know, they're aware, the sports directors, that they're talking to riders who are riding hard and fast. They're picking their moment when to relay that information as well. They're not talking to the riders when they're trying to go down a 20K descent, for example. So I think it adds a really interesting layer to the coverage. But, you know, it's not like we're watching tactical decisions being made in real time. Should we do some quick fire questions? We'll try and answer these ones very concisely, as if we're a sports director on the radio giving across some very precise information in as few words as possible. Something I find quite difficult, but here's question one.
Hey, Lionel and Graham. This is Javier from Vermont in the United States. I've been a listener since the Telegraph days, and one of the things I've always been curious about is, what is Watford like? I know that's been a long-term running joke. Being someone from the United States who doesn't have a sense of UK geography, I don't know what Watford's like. Is it a bit of a jab at Lionel, some funny poking? And also, where's not Watford? I tried looking on a map recently and didn't see a not Watford, but did see a North Watford. So is that shorthand in the UK for North? Again, I think this is, as a longtime listener, I think this is an inside joke that where I don't have the full punchline.
Well, Javier, well, Watford is, I'm going to say this, Graham, and you can jump in and correct me, but it's a satellite town of London. Even though it doesn't move anywhere, it doesn't go anywhere, it's a town very close to the London Orbital Motorway, the M25, which goes round the capital of England like a donut, really, doesn't it? And Watford is very close to the M25. It's kind of commuter belt, really. People who live in Watford, you know, they may well work locally, but also it's popular with people who work in London because it's well connected. It's only about 20 minutes on the train into the centre of London. And it's kind of the suburbs, really. It's actually on the London Underground network. You can get a tube train out to Watford if you so wish. It takes absolutely ages. But, you know, if you're ever in London and you're on holiday, I can recommend a trip to Cassiobury Park in Watford. But I don't live in Watford anymore. Did live there for a number of years, but the not Watford joke came out of the fact that when Richard Moore, Daniel Freeber and I were recording the podcast, Richard would say, you know, even when we were together on the South Bank, you know, he would say, oh, you've come in from, you know, not Watford. And that stemmed from the fact that Daniel didn't seem to know where I lived. He just assumed it was Watford, you know, years after I'd actually moved from Watford. So it became a bit of a running joke in that sense that I don't live in Watford, but I'm not saying I live in not Watford in order to disown Watford. The town of Watford is wonderful.
This message was approved by the Watford Tourist Board, I think.
The football team at the moment, not so much, but we won't get into that.
Next question, please.
Hi, Lionel and Graham. It's Pete Reynolds here from Castlemaine in Australia. Friend of the podcast and listener from the very start. My question relates to your colleague, Daniel Freeber. Obviously, he's at the tour. He's been producing the Paul Sexus series, but I don't think he's been on any of the cycling podcast daily shows. And you haven't really mentioned him traveling with you or staying with you. So I guess I was just wondering, are you kind of working in parallel at the tour this year, or is there a lot more, I guess, interaction that we don't see behind the scenes hopefully there's no kind of schism between you.
Well, Pete, I completely agree. Daniel's Paul Sexsass series, The Sexcast, was a phenomenal piece of work. I think it really added an additional dimension to our race coverage. It was the big story, certainly from the French perspective at the Tour de France. And as you said, Graham, it was, well, we were lucky that he was so well in contention all the way through the race. I mean, if he'd kind of faded away and finished in the sort of 40s or 50s, or if he'd not finished the race, the narrative arc of Daniel's series would have been very different. But no, it was an excellent series. We weren't travelling with Daniel, though, and certainly no kind of schism. Daniel and I continue to run the cycling podcast, but we're spread fairly thin, aren't we? We don't have...
But it is a question of taste. Just kidding. Sorry, Daniel.
No, we... Daniel was not necessarily going to be available for the cycling podcast this summer, and it wasn't until relatively close to the tour that he was available. And Graham, I'd already asked you way back in November whether you'd be happy to join me again at the Tour de France, and you said yes, very happy that you did so. And then, you know, for all sorts of logistic reasons, Daniel had some accommodation booked because he was intending to be at the tour in another capacity, but that wasn't where we were. So he was traveling with Gregor Brown, another colleague from the press room. And so the logistics of actually getting all three of us together night after night in the same place would have been challenging, because sometimes we'd have been heading in completely different directions to a different overnight base. And so rather than add to our sort of logistical challenges, Daniel and I had a chat about how he could offer some fantastic value to the cycling podcast in a slightly different format. And the Kilometre Zero series, as I say, it's absolutely second to none. But, you know, who knows? We happened upon a title sponsor for our Tour de France and Tour de France fam coverage at really the last moment from My Whoosh. Very grateful to them for supporting us. And that enabled us, you know, to have Daniel there at all. So hopefully in future years, we'll work out a way that we can cover a grand tour in the same car again. And we'll see, you know, if I can put up with 3 weeks of remote hideaways up in the miles from anywhere, and whether he can put up with my grouching and general sort of what's my biggest flaw at the Grand Tours? Probably getting hungry. At any point when I'm hungry, I'm an absolute nightmare to be around. So just keep me fed and watered, yeah, and I'm all right.
It's very much Jekyll and Hyde, isn't it? But 3 weeks of Free Boss specials, I'll go for that. Vineyards across the south and southwest of France. Great.
Oh, well, we'll have to see what happens when we pick the team for 2027, Graham.
Next question, please.
Hello, Graham and Lionel. My name is Trevor and I'm from Iowa. My question today focuses on tomorrow's stage, yesterday's dinner segment of your podcast. I'm always super drawn into learning more about the culture, your experience, the wine, the food. And my question today talks about, do you guys kind of curate some of those experiences, or do you just let them happen naturally when it comes to the podcast? Love to hear your input. Love the podcast and keep up the great work.
Well, Trevor, as much as I would like to, or like for us to take credit for that sort of level of planning, do we curate some of these experiences? Some of them we do, and we are far more likely to if we have, for example, Francois with us. But a lot of the time, it is, I'd say 9 times out of 10, Lionel, it is haphazard. And it's a case of you've got a good idea of what you might find, and you can plan accordingly. But it certainly isn't curated to any sort of level.
No, as much as I'd love to be almost like a sort of food show or a travelogue type show where you turn up and they're expecting you and they deliver the best food available. Really, the Tour de France schedule is so tight that it's not possible to make bookings too much in advance. One of the great joys of traveling with Francois was that he just knew towns. He knew somewhere everywhere. So he always had an eye on where he'd like to book us in. And he would, you know, he knew France as well. I mean, we know France, but, you know, he'd think, oh, the stage finishes there, we're staying here, but if we go 10 minutes down there, there's a fantastic restaurant that, you know, I know, and I'll book it. Whereas we tend, Graham and I, when we're at the tour, it's much more a case of, right, are we going to go to our hotel before we record, or are we going to record in the finished town? And then every decision comes subsequent to that, really. And once we finish recording, it's a case of looking around for somewhere that we can get dinner. And, well, we missed a couple, didn't we, really? Well, I think we were a bit late. We were a bit late once, weren't we? And then there was Bordeaux, where you had a touch of heat stroke and wanted ice cream for dinner. So we had no problem there.
Yeah, breakdown night. Simon Gill, the photographer, when his van broke down and we went out to rescue him is a bit strong, but when we went out to meet and console him, that was one of the, we've got a couple of reasonably good sandwiches that might still be okay in the car. We did talk about getting a cool box this year, but we didn't, but maybe next time that would be a very good idea for those sort of emergencies, the kind of break glass to open sort of cool box.
Hello, Lionel, and hello, Graham. This is Gilbert from Florida, huge fan of the Cycling Podcast and your work. The origin of the music for things like the Tour de France, the Giro, the Vuelta, Arrivé, and the Cycling Podcast. I'm just curious how you landed on those songs. They've become something of an anthem in my life, and they bring a smile to my face every time I hear it.
Lionel, you are the music man on this one. You'll have a much better idea of it than me. The Johnny Come Lately.
Well, I'm very much not the music man. I can talk you through some of our music choices, though. Amalatera, Coxe, is our Giro d'Italia theme tune. That was chosen by Daniel Freiber, who knew of this Italian pizzica band, and he asked them if we could use their music for our Giro coverage way back in 2016. It was our first Giro d'Italia recorded with daily episodes, and we've since done a live show with Amalatera, and the music is so evocative. I mean, to me, whenever I hear it, I just think of the Giro d'Italia. It just turns my whole mind a kind of calming, comforting pink, and you couldn't choose a better piece of music, I don't think.
Then it's a really lively piece of music as well. It's the opposite of calming and comforting music. I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah, but
it is the perfect choice.
I don't mean not in the sort of tempo sense, but there's something about it that just it sort of anchors me. It makes me there's a sort of reassuring familiarity to it now, and It's not necessarily typical of the whole of Italy. It's specific to the sort of southeastern corner, Puglia, that sort of region. And it's folk music, but it's fantastic music. And it really just says Italy in May to me. One of the first pieces of music we chose was for Kilometre Zero, and it's by Glass Pear. And there was some connection. Richard knew somebody in the band, and we asked their permission for that piece of music. Always makes me think about the Tour de France, the Glass Pear music. And our Tour de France theme is by a band, a pair of brothers, go by the name of Santoré, and it's called Ride On. And I think that really sums up the Tour de France for me as well. It does sound like a theme tune for a sports show, and it's got a sort of a French accent to it. And in common with a lot of our music, it was chosen by one of our producers, Tom Wally, who works now for Virgin Radio, used to work for BBC Six Music. He's the producer on the Huey Show, Huey from the Fun-Loving Criminals, and well, he's a DJ as well, makes his own music, and he just got that knack when it comes to finding the right music for podcasts as well. So there is, knocking around on Spotify, some playlists of Cycling Podcast music that we've used. I'll see if I can find a link to that and put it in a future edition of the 1101 Cappuccino.
Next question, please.
Hi, this is Barbara from Massachusetts in the US. Enjoyed the coverage very much this year for the tour. Every time I listen to the podcast, however, whenever I hear your promos quoting Seb Piquet, I can't figure out what the heck he's saying.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
Chute, blah, 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 cycling podcast team car in the back of the pack, please. What's the blah, blah, blah part?
So, Lionel, to slow this down, it's chute à l'arrière du peloton. So a crash at the back of the peloton, cycling podcast to the back of the pack, please, as if you were calling back a team car who needed to go and sort their rider out.
Yeah, and we're very grateful to Seb Piquet for lending his voice to the podcast for our little commercial break. And that signals that we've got an advert coming up. And of course, the adverts are what help the wheels go round here on the cycling podcast, aren't they? But there we are. That's what it is. And it's what the sports directors would hear, or a version of that would hear, on their radios in the team cars when there's been a crash in a race like the Tour de France or one of the others that Seb Piquet is radio tour for, which is basically all of the ASO races, including, I think he did the Tour de France Femme for the first time this year. And he also does UCI World Championships. So very well known and respected and liked figure in pro cycling is Seb Piquet.
Lionel, still a little bit of time to get through one or two more questions here. So next question, please.
Hi, cycling podcast friends. This is Jeff from Central Illinois in the United States. I've been listening to the podcast for a decade now, I think. I wanted to tell you about my friend Richard. He's 81 years old and he uses an e-bike. And this past weekend, we rode 45 miles together with a group of friends. And, you know, because of his e-bike, he was able to keep up with us and, you know, tackle any hill that we came upon. I think this is, you know, just a great example of how e-bikes are a net positive. Here he is, 81 years old, and he's staying fit and he's able to socialize. And I think we can all agree that that's vital as we grow older.
More of a statement, this, or more of a comment than a question, but Jeff, excellent nonetheless, riding with your 81-year-old friend on an electric bike. I had a very similar experience on Alpe d'Huez at the Tour this year.
I'm a long way from 81, Graham.
I'm sorry, I couldn't resist. But it gives us
oldies a chance, doesn't it? Eh? Gives us oldies a chance to be on an electric bike. I enjoyed it. I've been investigating whether to add one to my fleet of bikes just for emergencies.
I think if you can, it's a no-brainer. Hard agree from all of us here. Next question, please.
Hi, Lionel and Graham. This is Lynn from Essex in the UK. Friend of the podcast, enjoying your daily coverage of the tour and all your other content that you've produced over the past years. I have a 16-year-old daughter, Ellie, who has become a big cycling fan herself over the past few years. And she's at a point in her life now where she's starting to make career choices and is interested in becoming a cycling journalist. She's looked into journalism courses at universities and also at sports-specific journalism, but has found these to be quite football-heavy. So my question is, how did you guys both get into cycling journalism? And do you have any advice for someone just starting out their career?
Lionel, this is a nice one. And my first thought here was... So Lynn's daughter, if you're in terms of thinking about your career choices, you want to be a journalist first and then you want to figure out where that's going to take you. So the important thing is the qualification. And I get that sports journalism courses can be very football focused. And if that's not something that you want to do, then I would suggest that maybe that isn't for you. But find somewhere, whether it's and I appreciate that your chances to do this are far more limited now than they were certainly for Lionel and for me. But go and work in a newsroom, go and do work experience in a newsroom. It doesn't have to be on a topic that you sort of down a path where you see yourself going, but you want to learn the basics of being a good journalist first and then apply that to the topic that you want to focus on. And when that time comes, whether it's in a year's time or 2 or 3 years time, or even later, it might be something different altogether, but you've still got the opportunity to apply those basic skills to your subject of choice.
Yeah, I'd agree with that completely. I mean, the world has changed an awful lot since I trained as a journalist in the mid-90s. I went straight from school into journalism. I got an editorial assistant role at my local paper in Watford, the Watford Observer. And I wanted to be a sports journalist, and they told me, no, you need to qualify as a journalist first. So I did that and learned a whole range of skills, you know, how to report on anything really, from council meetings to court cases and community issues, as well as sports fixtures, and really kind of learned a range of skills. How to write sort of concisely, I think, how to report facts, how to verify facts, all of those things are skills that you need if you want to work in journalism. I think even more so as the sort of social media landscape changes, and we all become kind of journalists in a way, don't we? Because we can all publish, you know, from our smartphones. And I think it's learning some of those really important skills so that when you start to cover your favourite sport, you do so from a position of understanding kind of what the job of journalism is, which is to try and convey what's going on as fairly and accurately as possible. And yeah, I think I was very fortunate in that you could go and get work experience at a local paper, and that would then lead to the next step and the next step and the next step. Now, the media landscape has changed entirely since then. Most local newspapers, if they've survived, don't have offices anymore. Most of their staff work remotely. And so it is very difficult to get real world on the ground experience. So I would say, go and learn something you're interested in, you know, whether that's another subject, whether it's English, whether it's something that would, you know, help you in developing the sorts of skills that are useful for journalism. Don't necessarily think that you have to do a media type qualification in order to work in the media, because I think lots of people come to the media from studying something else. So I think keep your options open and try and add as many different skills as you possibly can. And I mean, if you're at university, they're bound to have some kind of university magazine, or, you know, I don't know. I mean, I didn't go to university, Graham. School of Hard Knocks for me, as you know. But, you know, just try and get involved with something that ticks the box of learning about how the media works, and then try and add as many skills as you possibly can, because the media now is not just about writing stories. In fact, that's probably almost the last thing on the list now. It's about being versatile. It's about turning your hand to a number of different ways to tell stories, whether that's in audio or video or photography or whatever it is. So I would say, don't specialise too soon. And if you're interested in the media as a whole, you don't feel the pressure to necessarily do a media qualification right at the start. It is something that you could get into a bit further down the line.
Yeah, look for something that will allow you or enable you to explore it and explore what you're interested in, with a bit more of a tangent. I started out, just to round this off, as an editorial assistant at a weekly trade magazine, a Haymarket magazine called Third Sector. And it was a magazine for the voluntary sector, so news magazine for the voluntary sector. But being editorial assistant meant that I got involved with everything. And that led me on to being a sub-editor there. And then as a sub-editor, you obviously get involved with writing a lot, and you kind of broaden out, or I broadened out from there.
But good luck. I mean, it's a great sport to work in or around. My only other note would be, just be aware that when you combine your hobby with your work, it means that boundaries can sometimes be quite tricky to observe. I mean, I'd never really watch a bike race for leisure, really. I'm always watching it with an eye on what we're going to be producing for the podcast, or something will pique my interest, or I'll start thinking about something for a later date. So yeah, it's a, but you know, on the other hand, what better industry to work in than something that really interests you? So if you, if it's what you want to pursue, go for it, gung ho. And you know, the harder you sort of bash your shoulder against the door, the more readily they'll open. I think that's always been the case in the media, and yeah, it's certainly the case now. You know, enthusiasm and a willingness to learn will take you a long way.
Next question, please.
Hi, Lionel and Graham. It's Michael from Adelaide, down under. I have a question, and it's probably directed more to you, Lionel. No offence, Graham, but Lionel, you've been in the game a little bit longer. I'm interested in understanding how much your day has changed. I see cycling is just getting quicker and quicker. The stages are getting shorter in time. That coupled with the fact that teams have their own media liaison officers and do a lot of their own PR work themselves. I'm wondering what the typical day is like now compared to what it was maybe when the cycling podcast first started. Is the day more challenging for you? Is it an easier day? Is it more hectic? Yeah, just interested in hearing how that plays out.
Lionel, can I just come in first off by thanking Michael for using the word hectic in the appropriate Aussie accent? Never is a word said better than when said in with an Australian twang. So thank you for that, first of all. But really, this is a question for you.
How has it changed? I mean, it has got faster paced, for sure. Like, it, we commented on it a lot during this year's tour, didn't we, Graham? The late starts to the stages appear to give the sense of kind of a leisurely start to the day. But it often ends up not feeling like that, because when you do get started, it's like the whole day is on fast forward from the minute you leave the hotel at the to go to the start. Then you feel like you're just half a pace behind all day until we put down the recorders and turn off the recording device and then go and try and find some dinner. I was thinking about this when we were at the tour, that sort of turbocharged feeling through the afternoon. And we were at Alpe d'Huez, and I rewarded myself with a lovely afternoon sat on the balcony watching the race approach us rather than us chasing around the race. But it reminded me of a stage in the Alps in the year 2000 when they went from Draguignan up to Briançon, and they went over the Col d'Izoard, and it was 249 kilometres, and the stage lasted at least 7 hours, seven and a half maybe. I think Santiago Botero won it, Colombian rider, and I can remember we got to the start so early. I think the stage must have started at 10, so we were getting to the start at half past eight in the morning, which was a good 4 hours earlier than we would get to a start these days, right? And then it just felt like the day dragged on and on. I was traveling with a photographer colleague, and we went to the Col d'Izoard, and we stood on the mountain and we waited for the riders to come up. And it just felt like, well, I mean, a whole day had elapsed. Like, you know, we'd driven up there, we'd waited for hours, we'd had some baguettes and ham and cheese for lunch, and I mean, back then, no mobile phones to watch the race on. So we really had no idea beyond what was being broadcast on Radio Tour, what was going on in the stage. And then the riders came, and then we descended down into Briançon. And then, you know, that was our day over. And it felt like, you know, 12 hours out for one stage of the Tour de France. But it kind of dragged, whereas now it feels like everything is happening at double quick time, and the pace of the tour moves on. The stories, you know, they flicker so briefly, don't they? The pace of the tour moves on so much faster. And I suppose that keeps you alert, doesn't it, Graham? We're always something that seems really important yesterday afternoon suddenly has been just washed away in the tide of new developments by the following day. And I think that from the point of view of the podcast, I mean, back then I was writing for a magazine, so I was writing a kind of a day in the life type piece of the tour reaching the Col d'Izoard, which is one of these kind of, you know, mythical mountains, really, just because it's so barren and bleak up there. But I also remember, like, David Miller was racing at the time, and he'd worn the yellow jersey right at the start of the tour, and he was starting to get really tired. And he was going around saying to anyone who would listen that basically the Tour de France is kind of inhumane when the stages are this long, 2 weeks into the race, a classic length stage. And I think even at the time, I thought he had a point. But looking back, I think he definitely had a point. The race doesn't need to be as long as that. In fact, as it's got shorter, it's got more explosive, it's got more interesting in a lot of ways. You know, we've always comment on how the stages themselves are like mini classics. I think that makes it easier and more enjoyable to cover because you don't get the feeling that the race settles into some kind of lull, a mid-race lull where really the old-fashioned transitional stages were just kind of formulaic. They were a breakaway and that was it, and everything stayed the same on GC. So I think that intensity has made it a different kind of job, and I think we do quite well, Graham, to sit down and just take a deep breath and try and to put into context before we start recording, like, what are we trying to convey here? What are the stories we're trying to cover and the things that we're trying to get across? So, yeah, has it changed? Undoubtedly. Maybe our coverage sometimes sounds a little bit frenetic. You know, it does sound a bit hectic at the end of the day.
That would be why. Because, the times that we don't stop and take a breath, I think we both notice it. And there have been times where we haven't done that because we are sort of really chasing our tails, and we've stopped the recording and just gone, no, hold on a second, we've not got this quite right. We do need to take a breath and we'll start over. Mm. Which means a late dinner, but it's worth it. It's important and it's worth it.
I think when we make a wrong turn in a recording, it's sometimes quite hard to correct. So it's almost better to just treat that one as just one for the cutting room floor and go again. Mm. Interesting point that Michael makes there as well about the team media. I've been thinking about this a lot, the way the cycling media itself has changed. And we talked about this, Graham, with our colleagues Ian and Kaylee from Escape Collective in the mashup episode, which you can still listen to. It's on the feed from just before the Tour de France Fam. I mean, initially when we saw this wave of PR people come into the teams and teams putting out their own media, filming their own riders, making their own content, you know, pumping it onto social media and YouTube and what have you. I'm certainly not going to say it doesn't have a place, because it definitely does. But I think it just amplifies the fact that having an editorial line and a sort of curating, if you like, a day on the Tour de France, which is sort of what we try to do. We try to observe those old-fashioned rules of journalism, which is going back to my training days when we were taught about how you cone out. Basically, you start with the headline, what's the most important angle, and that applies to any sports story or news story. What has happened? If you burst into the pub to tell people what had happened at the Tour de France and you've only got a sentence or two to get their attention, what would you say? And then you gradually add detail to that and you layer all of the information out, and you can maybe then you've bought yourself the freedom and flexibility to dive off into different cul-de-sacs avenues and explore other things in our coverage. I think those skills learn as a journalist, as you have as well, Graham. I think we possibly, in the heat of a three-week Tour de France, take for granted that a lot of that is kind of hardwired. We sort of know how to unpick a day on the Tour de France and sort it into some kind of order. Now, we don't always get it right. We don't always hit every note perfectly, but kind of there's a rhythm to each episode that just has come naturally over time. And I think that goes back to when me, Richard and Daniel were first covering the tour. We all knew instinctively on some level that there's six big subjects to tackle in this episode. Let's tackle them in an order. It doesn't necessarily have to be the biggest one first, but we have to have some kind of logical order to what we're discussing. And I think that there'll always be a place for that kind of curated approach to covering sport, because people don't have the time to go and delve through 23 teams' social media or YouTube channels to watch and, you know, take on board absolutely every angle. So we're packaging it up, really, aren't we? We're trying to produce a concise summary of what's happened at the tour, but with that added thing of this, you know, the caveat of this is how we saw it. We're not creating a definitive account of one day on the Tour de France because it's impossible to see everything. And we often pick things up overnight, don't we? Or see something in the evening or over dinner, or something emerges, as the stories often do. And then we reflect on it with a bit more calm the following day. So that's kind of how we work, really. And every day the podcast's out, and we kind of, it's like the audio fish and chip paper, as people used to describe the newspapers. You know, you record one, and whether it's been a good episode or a bad episode, or you've dropped an absolute howler, it's kind of gone. You've got to move on and regroup, regather for the next day.
A lot of subjects covered at any given day in the tour. A lot of subjects covered there on our third and, for now, final press conference of this Tour de France run. But thank you to everyone who has written in or sent a speak pipe question in. Please do keep them coming, because we want to figure out a way to include them in future, whether that's for us or whether it's for Daniel or whether it's for Rose and Denny and Lizzie. Please do keep them coming in. Lionel, before we hand over our baton to Daniel and his Vuelta coverage, is there anything else we need cover?
I don't think so. I mean, we've got a handover, haven't we? From croissants to chorizo, I suppose, isn't it? It's probably a better and more typical Spanish food than that, but I can't think of one off the top of my head at the moment. Very southern Vuelta this year, isn't it? It's going to be hot, hot, hot.
Andalusia, and then finishing in Granada.
Yeah, looking forward to it. I should be following the first week with my special Vuelta a España sunglasses on by the pool.
Good to know they'll be back in action. We do, of course, look forward to watching it, look forward to Daniel's coverage. And even if it is with one eye on it from a work point of view, we will still do our very best to enjoy it. That is that for now, Lionel. We will speak again on the pod in the reasonably near future, but to be confirmed.
Yeah, I think we'll have a look at whether a Tour of Britain recap episode is... we'll see if it's possible. First of all, we'll check the dates. My people will get together with your people, Graham. We'll just leave them to it, and we'll hopefully recap the Tour of Britain once that has happened.
There is one final bit of business before the Tour of Britain begins, talking of your people and my people, a bit of business from our Paris podcast end to the tour, and which director sportif out of you and I, Team Napalm, Schuf, 0%, Cassolet, and Pod Company, can you read a map? Which team came out on top? Now, I know I can tell you the figures from our Instagram poll. You will have to bring the figures from the Substack newsletter, but I just want to say thank you to the thousands of people who have written in to tell me how much better my team was and vote for Pod Company, can you read a map, via email, via social media, and snail mail. So thank you for the mailbag that I'm still going through to congratulate me on my choices and say how much better Pod Company, can you read a map was in terms of the overall team.
Well, what was the percentage on Instagram?
It was 57-43, so 57% in favour of Team Napalm Schuf, 0% Cassolet.
We are 60-40 on Substack, so I'm afraid that's a trouncing, Graham. I had Tadej Pogacar. I mean,
I actually did better than I thought.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Pedersen and Pogacar double. I thought with Del Toro, Sexas, Kuss, Skelmoser, and Healy, and Van der Poel for that matter, I thought that collective would have been looked on slightly more favourably, but there you are.
No hard feelings. We'll do it again next year, Brian.
Looking forward to that. Shall we say goodbye for now? And Daniel, vamos.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.